Very good evening to you, everyone, and a warm welcome. Thanks for coming along for a Bible class. Brother Evan Franco with us this evening. We look forward to his first installment on the subject, the prophet Elijah. And as you can see from the overhead in front of us, that his emphasis tonight is going to be on empathy and learning about empathy from God. He's asked, basically, that we'll take a reading later, so I'll call him up right away now.
Thanks, Rob. Now, what we're going to do, we're going to get a bit of a handout for the more, I guess, the more academically minded amongst us, if you're interested in that. What we are looking at is Elijah, but more specifically than I, we want to think about empathy. They're two ideas that don't really go hand in hand.
So Elijah and empathy aren't ideas that generally get put together. Because he's not a very empathetic person. However, in this chapter, we actually find that he is. And so that's what we sort of want to draw out a little bit tonight. And what we'll see is that tonight's, yes, it's about empathy. It's also about our relationship that we have with God and developing that relationship with him. And as we're going through it, we'll see, we'll deal with Elijah and we'll deal with the widow. I don't know if this is what they actually looked like, but sort of just guessing. I'm guessing he didn't have those sort of, well, you can't even see his clothes. Anyway, they didn't look like that, I don't reckon, but it's a nice picture. So we're dealing with the Elijah and the widow, and we're going to take a reading in a second from 1 Kings 17. But what I want us to do is to think about the situations that Elijah and the widow faced, because they both faced very similar situations. But their response to that was really quite different. And it comes down to, I think there's a few factors, but I'm not going to tell you about those just yet. You can sort of figure those out for yourself as we go along. Elijah went through a drought. The widow went through a drought. Elijah lost a little boy. He lived upstairs from him. He would have been quite close with him. The widow also lost a little boy. And their responses are really very different in their response to their trials. What we're going to see as we go on is that Elijah actually showed in his response the response that God showed to him when he was going through his trial. He is then going to show that same response that God showed to him to the widow. And that response actually turned the widow around from the position that she was in. So we're going to do a reading in a minute, but while we're doing that, I actually want us to have a bit of a think about what was similar and what was different between Elijah and the widow. So, does it work?
Yes.
I'm used to these from school. So I'll put the similarities over this side. Differences here. I just want to think about what's similar and what's different between them, because there's a lot of similarities and there's also a lot of differences. And the differences is what's actually going to show us why, or I think, why Elijah responded in a different way. Now, just before we get started on that, though, because it's a bit of an obscure... This one doesn't work. A bit of an obscure passage. What do we already know about Elijah and the widow of Zarephath? Just have a think for, 10 seconds.
When he was a Tishbite, she was from Zarephath.
She was what?
From Zarephath.
She was.
From different parts of...
Yeah, so from... So from different areas.
Gentile.
Yep, so she was a Gentile. Do we know anything else about it? What do you remember about the story? She was about to die. Okay. How? How do we remember?
We're all through Elijah's life, showing faith to God.
Yep.
And then the widow here, She listened to what was said and she did what Elijah said based on Elijah saying this is what God is saying.
Yep. Okay. All right. So we've got, it's a bit disconcerting actually. We've got the widow and the Elijah. Now, remember in the story, Elijah actually gets, he goes to Ahab and he tells Ahab there's going to be a drought. And then he goes and hides himself at the brook Cherith. Okay, and the ravens and the brook were there. That's the feeding of Elijah during that time. Then Elijah gets told to go to Zarephath and a widow is going to look after him. And the widow does look after him and she's given food by Elijah when she's got nothing left. And then later on in the chapter, her little boy dies. And then Elijah raises him to life. So that's the story that we're sort of looking at in this. And when we're going through it, just think about what is similar between Elijah and what is different between Elijah and the widow. So we'll get Ralph to read that now, and then we'll get into it.
So reading from the first book of Kings in chapter 17. Now Elijah the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, "As the Lord God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word." And the word of the Lord came to him, "Depart from here and run eastward and hide yourself by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. You shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there." So he went and did according to the word of the Lord. He went and lived by the brook Cherith that is east of the Jordan. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. And after a while the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him, "Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you." So he arose and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, "Bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink." And as she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, "Bring me a morsel of bread in your hand." And she said, "As the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. And now I am gathering a couple of sticks that I might go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat and die." And Elijah said to her, "Do not fear. Go and do as you have said, but first make me a little cake of it and bring it to me, and afterward make something for yourself and your son. For thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil shall not be empty, until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth." And she went and did as Elijah said, and she and he and her household ate for many days. The jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by Elijah. After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill, and his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. And she said to Elijah, "What have you against me, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son." And he said to her, "Give me your son." And he took him from her arms and carried him up into the upper chamber where he lodged and laid him on his own bed. And he cried to the Lord, "O Lord, my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn by killing her son?" Then he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to the Lord, "O Lord, my God, let this child's life come into him again." And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper chamber into the house and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son lives." And the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth."
Okay, thanks, Ralph. So, as we're reading through that,
do you need this?
I will a bit.
Because we can change it.
I don't.
Drag the table to you.
You know what I'm going to do, though? I'm probably going to end up going back over there quite a bit. Because I'm sort of just winging it at the moment.
Okay. You just look really comfortable over there. So.
Once I get this part out of the way. All right. So looking at the similarities and differences, did you find any similarities at all between Elijah and the widow? Not really? I found a few.
Well, by the end, they had a similar faith.
Okay.
Like, she believed in the word, the Lord spruced out of his mouth. But at the beginning, it was a sort of difference because it was Elijah the whole time. It was Elijah who came on.
What about God feeding Elijah and then Elijah feeding the woman? Yeah, well, by the end, God feeds Elijah.
Yep.
And they both bring bread.
I was going to say bread fed. Are there any other similarities that you could find?
He was having to hide when she was at first.
Say that again. That would be more the difference,
yeah,
though, wouldn't
that's
it?
Different. Yeah.
So the similarity would be that they're both, in a sense, condemned to death. Like the woman by the drought and the famine, and Elijah by the decree of the king. Both condemned to death.
Yep. Are there any others that we can think of?
They both had to commit to the process. So they weren't sure that outcome, but they had to go along with it.
Yeah, so committing in faith.
I guess, like, even though we were said they're from different areas, both the areas were offended by the famine. The famine wasn't just the Israelites.
So the woman
was almost unaware that God was working in her life at first.
Yeah. What is it saying? What's it saying? Is it verse?
There's like a command that a woman there to save me.
Yeah, we don't know much more about that though, do we?
No.
Another similarity, this one might be a bit of a stretch, but it's to do with Jezebel. Because Jezebel is, in a technical sense, Elijah's queen of Israel.
Yep. I think about some of the differences that they had. One of them was the amount of time that they actually had been in the truth. So Elijah would have grown up in the truth. Whereas the widow, I mean, she might have only, you know, heard of God maybe a month before. We don't know how long, but it certainly isn't long. And the amount of time that they had to develop a relationship with God. So the widow obviously had a lot less time than Elijah had, whereas Elijah had a lot of time. So that's one difference. Another difference could be... Actually, I've got them up here. I should probably put them up. Okay, so we've got a lot of these similarities anyway. Believed in God, gone through the drought. She feared for the life of her son and her. Elijah feared for his life. They both needed to rely on God in an impossible situation. And then God communicated directly with them in some way. But the difference is that, really, I think, is their background. So Elijah grew up in the truth, spent a lot of time in isolation. We'll see that in the first verse. He didn't actually have any family and had a long time to cultivate a relationship with God, whereas the widow is in a very different situation. So she grew up in a Gentile city, which is actually Jezebel's hometown, as Seb mentioned. She lived in the city, possibly had an immoral lifestyle. We know that, well, we don't know that. We're assuming that from later in the chapter when she says, "Oh, why have you called my sin upon me, killing my son, or brought my sin to remembrance?" And she was only recently visited by God. Now, to me, this is why they responded so differently. Is that amount of time that they had to develop that relationship with God. So that different background sort of led to a bit of a different response. And like I said, if you go to verse 1, we can actually see where that difference is. So 1 Kings 17, verse 1, it's actually here. Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the inhabitants of Gilead, and that's it. Now I think, well, what? How does that tell us where how Elijah had more time? Well, in actual fact, if this is my very crude map of Israel, it's easier to draw than Australia. Tishbi is actually over here in sort of Naphtali area up here. That's where Tishbi is. I think that's in like the apocryphal book of Tobit. It's over there. So that's where Elijah's from. But where does it say where else does it say he's from? Gilead. Elijah the Tishbite from the land of Gilead. So he's not in Tishbi anymore. Where's Gilead? It's over the other side here, isn't it? A very remote place. So what he's done is, and I'm sort of assuming this, he's grown up in Tishbi in the city, but he's actually separated himself away from that and gone to Gilead, which is a really remote place. And it's in those remote places that he had time to develop that relationship. And that's quite often the case. We need to give ourselves that time to spend with God, whether it's driving to work or whether it's moving out into the country or whatever it is. But that's where we develop our relationship, when we actually stop what we're doing and give God time. Moses, where did he learn the truth? He learned it out in the backside of the desert, in Exodus 3. John the Baptist, voice of one crying in the wilderness. And here's Elijah out in the back of nowhere. So I just wonder, how much time do we actually give to God? It's very easy, you know, we get caught up in work and family and ecclesial activities and all that sort of thing, to just go from one thing to the next, and it's just like this snowball effect. And sometimes we just need to arrest that and just make it just stop, so we can physically make the time for God. Just to give you an example, when Kate and I were living in Newcastle, this is going back a little while now, we would be out literally every night of the week. Monday night, we had Messiah practice. This is just before we moved into the country, actually. Messiah practice Monday night. Tuesday night, I had to go to my parents' place for dinner. We didn't get a choice about that. Wednesday night, the clicky. I think you all understand what that's like sometimes. So we had to go there for Tuesday night. Wednesday night was the class. Thursday night, because we both worked, we had to do the shopping. Friday night was youth group. Saturday night, well, there's always something on Saturday night. Sunday night, it's the lecture. And then you're back to Messiah practice on Monday. That was every day. And it was fun. But where is time in that busy work or family or ecclesial life for God? We might be going to things, but where do I actually get to spend quality time and quantity time with God? And it's a challenging thing. Now, Elijah up and moved into the country. Now, we just can't do that. When Kate and I actually got, when I got posted out into Forbes in the middle of New South Wales, there was literally nothing there. I think it's a town of about 10,000 people. So there's nothing there. There's nothing to do. And it was boring. But it's at those points, and that was probably the point in my life where I've actually been at my spiritually strongest. And I'd spend hours just walking the dog, going down the stock route and just letting her off the chain and just walking. Every afternoon after work, I'd go down there because there's nothing to do. And that was a very important time for me. So how much time do we actually spend with God. Just time. I sometimes wonder whether we can spend more. I'm sure we can spend more, actually. So there's Elijah, and I think that's probably the reason for why he responded in a different way to his trials, which were very similar to what the widow went through, why he responded differently. So Elijah comes onto the scene. He says, there's not going to be any more rain. And then verse 2, the word of the Lord came to him saying, get thee hence, turn the eastward, and hide thyself by the brook Cherith, that is before Jordan. And it shall be that thou shalt drink of the brook, and I've commanded the ravens to feed thee there. So he went and did according to the word of the Lord, and he went and dwelt by the brook Cherith, that is before Jordan. And the ravens brought him bread and flesh in the morning, and bread and fresh flesh in the evening, and he drank of the brook. And there's more time. He's away from everything again, just there by the brook. But this is a trial for Elijah. This would be an enormous trial. He's a wanted man. We know that from the next chapter. And Ahab's sending people out everywhere, and that's why Elijah's told to go to this sort of remote place where no one's going to find him. And then it stops raining. He's told to go to a brook, not a river. And that's a trial. Yeah.
The words that are just coming from the page here just remind me really strongly of the trial of Christ, you know, where he's in the wilderness as well, and the example of Elijah's experiencing is now in this life further away.
Yeah, that's right.
And every word that we see is down there.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many echoes through through the whole passages about Elijah to Christ, and there's some on the worksheet. I think towards the end we might, if we've got time, look at it. There's tons of those sorts of things that come through, aren't there? Right, and that's what Elijah needed to learn. You know, I think my whole view of Elijah is that he needed to learn acceptance of others, which was just so foreign. Eventually he did, but he needed to learn it for the Gentiles, and that's, I think, what's happening here with the widow. But he needed to learn it with his own brothers and sisters, seeing that they're different to him, and that's okay. So when we come back to here to this trial, think about what he's going through here. This is pretty intense. He's got to accept food from the ravens. Now, according to Job 38, ravens can't even feed their own young. So he's got to rely on an impossibility here for that to happen. Some people think that they might have got the food from Ahab's storehouses, which is, it's a nice idea. It's a bit ironic, but might be. We don't know. But then he's not going to a river, he's going to a brook. And then in verse 7, what else happens? This is the second trial, so he's got to rely on an impossibility. Verse 7, and it came to pass after a while that the brook dried up because there's been no rain. So you can just imagine Elijah day by day just waking up and hearing the brook, and gradually it starts to get a bit softer and softer. And no doubt at this point in time, he's praying to God saying, there's not much water left. And we get to the point where the water stops trickling and it just turns into puddles. And those puddles start to get a bit stagnant and then they just go into mud and there's no water. What do you do? If that's you and you know there's a drought and you know you've got no water, and God has said, go to the brook, and now what God's provided for you has dried up, what do you do? How would you react to that? There's a few things we could do. You know, we could take it into our own hands. We could up and leave, say, right, this is ridiculous. God said he'd provide for me, and now there's just nothing. I'm going to find water. He didn't do that. He could have said, "Oh, God, what have you done? Why have you done this?" He could have cursed God. He could have argued with God, but he doesn't. He could have said, "Oh, God can't be trusted. He said he'd save me and he hasn't." What does he do? You panic? Do you get scared? I'm sure Elijah was scared. In fact, I'm certain he'd be scared because he doesn't know. Everyone out there is looking for him. He's here with no water. God's told him to go to this place, and now what God's provided has dried up. That would be a pretty panicky situation. But he waited. He just waited. He waited for God to act. He didn't take things into his own hands. He actually let God act for him. I think there's a lesson for us in that. That when we do go through trial, how often do we want to get ourselves out of it? Without prayer, for instance. And I'm certain that Elijah would have been praying. How often do we go into it thinking, "No, I know what I'm going to do, and I'm going to take this step and this step and this step," and we sort of leave God out of the picture? How often do we do that? I think it'd be very easy to fall into that trap myself. But Elijah didn't. He let God take control, and he left it in God's hands. So, that's pretty rough. And then God answers his prayer. But he answers it in a way that actually sends Elijah into more of a trial. Because it's like going from the boiling pot into the fire now. So before it was sort of hidden. Now he's actually got to go to Zarephath. So verse 8, "And the word of the Lord came to him saying, Arise, get to Zarephath, which belongs to Zidon, and dwell there. Behold, I've commanded a widow woman there to sustain thee." So he's got to up and leave down here at the brook Cherith, around there somewhere, and he's got to go all the way up here, we'll take that out of the way, to Zarephath, up there between Tyre and Sidon. It's on that sort of main trade route there. So he's got to travel all this way, which is about a 5-day journey, to get to there. Now, what's he going through? He's going through Israel. Who's looking for him? Ahab and all his army. They're looking for him. So he'll be ducking and weaving all over the place just to get through it. Now, that in itself is huge. Put on top of that, the fact that it's a drought and he's got no water, where is he going to get the water from? He might get some out of the Jordan, I guess, but there's not a lot around. He's got to go that 5-day travel that direction while Ahab's hunting for you. And he's got to go to Zarephath, which is between Tyre and Sidon, on the main trade route between the two of those. And Zarephath's a small town. When we lived in Forbes, there's a small town just out of town called Ugarra. If you go through that way, it's a very nice little town. But it's 600 people. And everyone knows everyone and everyone's business. It's unbelievable. I used to teach some of the kids there and they'd be saying, "Oh, this person's doing this and this person's doing that and they're going on this holiday." And could just mind your own business, but no, they know everything about everyone. And so Elijah's told to go to this widow in this small town. He's told to go to a widow in a small town. A single woman with a son in a small town. You reckon people might talk? I reckon they might. Okay. "Oh, did you hear about Elijah's going with the widow? Oh, right. Oh, happy days." Okay, we could have a romance going on here, they might think. And the talk would be rife. That's not in the Bible, by the way. That's just me making stuff up. That is actually, for Elijah to go there, a huge deal. And just to step out, take that first step in faith that God's actually going to look after him, that would be terrifying. But he does it. He understands fear and he understands faith. And he goes out overcoming that fear in faith. And that lesson that Elijah's learning in doing that is exactly what he's going to teach the widow. Step out in faith, overcome that fear. That's what he's going to teach her. So, I don't think I'm even going to bother with my notes. They're all over the place at the moment. Let's go to verse, what verse are we up to? Verse 10. So he arises, and he went to Zarephath. Now, who is this widow woman? What do we actually know about her? This is a widow who I think is in the truth. I think she's a believer. Maybe not before God visited her or commanded her to look after him. But certainly now, and there's a few indications that tell us this. She's someone that's had a revelation from God. She's acting in a way that's similar to what Abraham does. Remember when Elijah comes to her, he says, get me some... We might as well read it. Verse 10. So he arose and went to Zarephath, and when he came to the gate of the city, behold, the woman was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, fetch me, I pray thee, a little water in a vessel that I might drink. And as she was going to fetch it, that in itself is remarkable, a remarkable attitude. He called to her and said, bring me, I pray thee, a morsel of bread in thine hand. And she said, as the Lord God lives, I have not a cake, but a handful of meal in a barrel and a little oil in a cruse. And behold, I'm gathering two sticks that I may go and dress it for me and my son, that we may eat it and die. That's what she's going through. But she doesn't count the cost. This is someone that just goes out. She gives water in a drought. She goes and makes Elijah a cake. Not a huge one, but just a little ash cake. That's what it is. Not a feast cake, an ash cake. She says, I haven't got enough for a feast cake, but I've got enough for an ash cake. But in doing that, she's actually technically cutting short the life of her son. Because he's not going to have as much food. You know, granted, it might only be a few more days, but she's still cutting it short. In a similar way to Abraham, when he was doing that with Isaac. But even though she's doing these sorts of things, she's showing hospitality, she's showing that she's a believer, she's showing that she's living the truth, as it were. Even if that's the case, she's struggling. She's a woman that is really struggling with her faith. And that's, we go through that from time to time. We do struggle. Sometimes it is a real struggle to just put one foot in front of the other in terms of faith. But we can do it. And that's what Elijah's teaching her. Yes, we might be going through the motions of ecclesial life and, you know, hospitality and those sorts of things. And sometimes we might be really struggling with our own personal conviction. But Elijah's saying we can get through that. And he's going to show her how to do it. Because we can see she is struggling. Verse 12, what does it say? It says, and as she said, as Yahweh thy God lives. As Yahweh your God lives. One point he might have been her God, but now she's really struggling. And then what's it say at the end? We're going to eat it and die. We think, you know, a month earlier, God had come to her and said, Elijah's going to come, he's going to look after you. And she might have believed that to start off with, but now she's at the point, she's gone through the exact same thing as Elijah with the puddles, and Elijah's saying, well, Elijah's come on the scene, but she's saying, you know what, I did believe that, and now it's just, I can't see any way out, and now I'm just gathering those two sticks, and we're going to die. I'm going to cook up a meal, and that's it. We're done. And she's actively showing that she's struggling with her faith. And that's heartbreaking. But the best part of this is the empathy that Elijah has learned from God. He's now going to show that to the woman. The very first thing that he says to her, when she says this, he says, don't be afraid. Now, who else knows fear like Elijah? Right? Go to a brook. You see the puddles. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. He knows that all too well. He's seen that water seep down into the mud. He's known that fear, having to rely on the ravens. He's known that fear, having to walk through Ahab and Jezebel's kingdom. but he was perceptive enough to know that that's what she was going through. He was perceptive enough to know that she was scared. And a lot of the time when we're facing these trials, or we're facing the unknown, or these problems that we've got, we are scared. We're scared of the unknown. We're scared of the impacts that might happen to our family. We're scared of the potential changes in our lifestyle. Sometimes we're just scared and we don't know why. And we can't really put our finger on it. For her, she was scared of death. She was scared of the impacts that were going to affect her little boy. She was scared of being hungry. So Elijah says, "Fear not. I know what you're going through. I've been there." And that simple phrase from Elijah was enough to get her to change her mind, to change her mindset. Yes, it was a test of faith to her, but Elijah's encouragement actually helped her through that. So when we talk about empathy in Elijah, the two don't normally go together, but here we can actually see a lot of empathy on Elijah's part. It's almost like he got his arms around her and said, "It's okay, I've been there, I understand it, and we can take this next step together." And that's exactly what happened. Verse 16. Elijah said, "Fear not. Go and do as you've said, but make me a little cake first and bring it to me, and then make for thee and thy son. For thus says the Lord God, the barrel of meal shall not waste, neither shall the cruse of oil fail until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth." And she went and did according to the saying of Elijah. And she and he and her house did eat many days. And the barrel of meal wasted not, neither did the cruse of oil fail according to the word of Elijah, which he spoke. Sometimes when we're going through trial, all we need is someone to just empathise with us. Just to empathise with us and give us some encouragement to continue, to listen to our concerns and not contradict us, because Elijah didn't contradict her. He could have said things like, "Don't be an idiot. Don't be a fool. Come on, really? I'm here." He could have said that, but he doesn't. He doesn't contradict her and say, "You know, I thought you had faith." He doesn't do any of that sort of thing. But what he does do is he gets around her. He says, "Yes, there doesn't seem to be a light at the end of the tunnel at the moment, but you know what? The tunnel's curved, and you can't see it just yet, but it's coming." And he gives wise counsel from God. And she carried on. She carried on. And then Elijah lived upstairs from her for many days. And they talked about the truth. I'm certain they talked about the truth. They would have had to. I think that there's allusion to that when she says, "Ought to be called my sin to remembrance." She would have talked about that. Would have talked about her lifestyle perhaps previously. Would have talked about the immorality that Jezebel is propagating out of the capital. It would have talked about the fact that her father was the king in Zidon, Ethbaal. We've talked about all of that and the apostasy that's going on. And then she's hit with a massive blow in verse 17. "It came to pass after these things that the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, fell sick. And his sickness was so sore that there was no breath left in him. And she said to Elijah, 'What have I to do with thee, O thou man of God? Are you come to call my sin to remembrance and to slay my son?'" So she's upset, and who wouldn't be? We can understand her situation 100%. Like it's so extremely intense what she's going through. She's in pain. She's in a lot of pain. And as a result, what she's done is she's actually made some statements that are not accurate, some statements that aren't true. She's made extreme statements. "What have I to do with thee?" What did your version say, Ralph? It didn't say, "What have I to do with thee?" It said something different. It's verse 17 or 18.
She says, "What have you against
Yeah, what have you against me? Elijah hasn't got anything against her that we know of.
But she says straight away, every man of God, so she's still passing it through.
Hmm.
You had on one of the previous slide, your God.
Hmm. So there's been that change. There's a definite shift there. But now she's going through this extreme trial and she's saying things that she wouldn't, I think, ordinarily say. What have I to do with thee? If it wasn't for Elijah, she would be dead. So logically, it's an untrue statement. She's mocking Elijah, I think, as a man of God. So what have I to do with thee, O thou man of God? So are you really a man of God if you've allowed this to happen? Almost like mocking of Christ, isn't it? And she perceived things that were different from the reality. Because Elijah hasn't actually said a bad word to her. He hasn't said anything bad to her.
Considering as well that her son lived many more days than he could.
Mm. Yeah. So there's issues here. And that trial that she's going through is actually... you can understand the pain that she's in. And she's making these statements that are just not true. What have I to do with you? Why have you allowed this to happen? And we can understand that hurt. And when we're going through that sort of pain, it's hard to be rational. But what's Elijah's response? What's Elijah's response? Verse 19. And he said, "Give me thy son." And he took him out of her bosom and carried him into a loft where he abode. And he laid him upon his own bed. And he cried to the Lord and said, "O Lord my God, hast thou brought evil upon this widow with whom I sojourn by slaying her son?" Prayer. That was the response of Elijah, was to pray. Now, there's no doubt that he's going through those same emotions, maybe not to the same extent, that the woman is. He lived upstairs from the little boy. He would have seen him every day. You know, he might have come in of a morning and jumped on his bed. So, "Oh, Elijah, wake up." We don't know, but that's the sort of relationship I'd picture them having. Elijah would have been hurting here as well, but his response wasn't accusation. It was prayer. And his prayer is an absolutely remarkable one. It's a beautiful prayer. Just have a look at this. I didn't put the verses up there, but this one here. This is Matthew chapter 6, just before the Lord's Prayer. "When you pray, enter into your closet." What's Elijah done? He's taken the boy, he's gone upstairs. "And when you've shut the door," which is what Elijah did, "and pray to your father which is in secret, and your father which sees in secret will..." "Then your father which sees in secret will reward you openly," which is exactly what's happened with the little boy. He's been risen up and he's there, and it's in the open for everyone to see. "But when you pray, use not vain repetitions." And Elijah's prayer here, there's no repetition that we're going to see in the next chapter. "Obey, I'll hear us," for hours. None of that vain repetition. This is a heartfelt, sincere and genuine prayer. Let's just read it again. "And he cried," it's an emotional prayer. "He cried unto Yahweh and said, O Yahweh, my God, have you brought evil upon the widow with whom I sojourn by slaying her son?" And Yahweh heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came into him again, and he revived. He stretched himself upon the child and cried, "O Yahweh, my God, I pray thee, let this child's soul come into him again." A simple, heartfelt and emotional prayer. And it worked. And it's a prayer of faith. That's what this is saying up here. This is James chapter 5. "And the prayer of faith shall save the sick." We had a look at this, didn't we, a few weeks ago in terms of spiritually sick, but there's also that physically sick element to it. "Shall save the sick, and the Lord will raise him up." So pray one for another that you might be healed. The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. You know what the next verse is? Elijah prayed. In the very first chapter, a very, very first verse of this chapter, he prayed for a drought. So there's definitely that connection with Elijah and prayer. And it's an effectual and a fervent prayer that he prayed. So Elijah's response really is the ideal. That's what we need to aim for. When we're in trial, is that our first port of call has to be prayer. And what the widow could have done, she could have actually sought Elijah out and not let him go into that room alone. She would have grabbed hold of him and gone up there with him and prayed with him. But she didn't. And so when the boy's raised up again and Elijah brings her down, you just imagine the joy and the relief that she would have felt. Verse 22. And the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down out of the chamber into the house and delivered him unto his mother. And Elijah said, "See, thy son lives." And the woman said to Elijah, "Now by this I know that thou art a man of God, and that the word of the Lord that is in thy mouth is truth." And she turned around again. So just by Elijah doing those things, by talking to her, he's actually been able to take this woman from a struggling situation spiritually to a strong situation. Fear not. I'll take your burden on for you and praise for her. Because at that point in time, she's probably all over the place emotionally and mentally as well. And it was that action of Elijah that actually caused her to turn. That's remarkable. Now, I want you to turn something up. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 11. Because this woman is in there. Not mentioned by name, but she's there. Hebrews 11, verse 35. You know, there's only two women in Scripture, in the Old Testament at least, and this is in the context of the Old Testament, two women that received their dead to life again. One was done by Elijah, the other was done by Elisha. Two women. Verse 35, women received their dead to life again. There she is. There's the widow of Zarephath in Hebrews chapter 11. And what was it that caused her faith to turn around, to become really strong? It was Elijah. It was Elijah's actions of comfort and empathy that he showed to her that turned her around. Or got it back on track, as it were. He learned from his trials, and he was then able to impart that learning and that comfort that God gave to him onto her. So, when we're learning from our trials, how can we learn from our trials? We can learn from them in a couple of ways. Trials rightly met can cause spiritual growth. Since we're in Hebrews, we'll come back go over a couple of pages to Hebrews chapter 12, verse 11. Hebrews 12, verse 11. So lift up the hands that hang down and the feeble knees. Make straight the paths of your feet, lest the lame which is lame be turned out of the way, but rather let it be healed. And this is in the context of, this is Isaiah 35, isn't it? He's talking about the trials that people are going through. And he says, but lift up the hands that hang down. Verse 11 is the one I was after, not that one. No chastening. There we go. No chastening for the present seems to be joyous but grievous. No one likes trial. No one enjoys it. It's grievous. Nevertheless, afterwards, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them that are exercised thereby. What's exercise? It's training, isn't it? So if you're going to do a marathon, you've got to train. If you're going to run 40 kilometres, you've got to start with one. I might have to start with maybe 50 metres. But it gradually you get stronger as you're going through that. Those that are exercised thereby. And in Elijah's situation, he was exercised. He had that time at the brook, for instance, where he needed to go through that fear and learn faith. He learned to rely on God, and he had his belief developed in that way. He learned what it was to go through trial and then to use that learning to help others. And it taught him to reach out to other people. That's the peaceable fruit of righteousness for Elijah. For the widow, it's a spiritual growth, which is seen in that last verse, isn't it? Now, I know now, I'm absolutely certain that Yahweh is God. So that's the first thing we can learn. The second thing is about when we've gone through trial, what have we learned from that process? We've learned what we need. Sorry, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say empathy.
Yeah. We can learn empathy because we've been through it. We know what people need if we've been in something similar. We can identify with them. We can understand what they're going through. We can listen to them. We can offer hope. We can actually take their burden off them, which is what Elijah did literally with the little boy. He took him out of her arms and took her burden on him. He did something physically for them. And that's what we can do in learning from our trials. And we can learn to go to God in prayer on behalf of others. So what our trials do is they allow us to empathise with people that are going through something similar to what we have in our own lives. We said earlier, these are some of the things that Elijah experienced. But just look at what God said. So Elijah's being pursued by Ahab. God says, go to the brook. He's spoken to him. He's given him wise counsel. But then he does something and he hides him. Elijah's response is positive. There's drought. God speaks to Elijah. He says, I've commanded ravens. And he gives him some hope there. And then he does something. So there's that conversational aspect and the physical actually doing something aspect. He's running out of water. Okay, go to Zarephath. And then he provides the widow. So God has done something for Elijah spiritually and physically. So she stepped outside and done something for him. Not just said, just go to Zarephath and, you know, I've commanded ravens and not provided any ravens. He's actually done something about it. What about Elijah with the widow? He speaks to her and then he provides food. That's exactly what God has done. He spoke to Elijah and he provided food. He speaks to the widow and through God's power provides food. And her response, she turns around and it's positive. With the death of her son, he says, give me your son, and he prays. And he takes her burden off her. And then there's that positive response as well. But Elijah only learned that because of what he'd gone through himself. And he actually learned that empathy that he was able to show the widow directly from God. I think that's pretty amazing, actually. I like that. That's sort of the ideal of what God manifestation is about, isn't it? We read what it says and we do something. So I think that's where we might wrap it up for now. It's 8:30, so that'll do.